your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasoline. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now your host, Rick Moore.
Yeah, so fresh and light and lively outside and in the studio. And you know why? Because fundraiser event is over. So many people have given. Thank you so much for all those who given last week to Bluegrass, Wake Up Call, and WNRN as a whole. Special thanks to the family and friends who supported us. Sean McCord here, Rusty Simpre. Woo-ha! So now start saving your bucks for the fall. Let me also thank Blue Ridge Graphics for their support. Blue Ridge Graphics at Meade Avenue and East High Street, serving Charlottesville with custom t-shirts, sportswear, and professional graphic design since 1979. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746. And online, it's brgtshirts.com. Special thanks as well to those over in Lovingston and the 94.7 dial. All right, I think today's topic applies to everyone, or certainly to someone that we know. Rebecca Tippett. Rebecca, how are you?
Doing well. How are you doing, Rick?
I'm quite well, and I'm really interested in today's program. We're going to be talking about near poverty, a little bit about poverty itself, but near poverty, especially in the state of Virginia. Rebecca Tippett from UVA's Weldon Cooper Center for Public Service. How do you get all that out? Does that even fit on a business card?
It looks a little cluttered.
Rebecca has recently done a study. I don't have my paper turned right side up. What's the official name of your study?
Building Economic Security for Virginia Families. And it's a look at income and asset adequacy among Virginia households.
Income and asset adequacy. A little less, jargonish. What is that?
So the idea is that if you expand beyond a look at poverty, which in the United States, the federal poverty line is a useful measure of deprivation of people who are really, truly struggling to meet their basic needs and cannot do so without assistance. And we know that almost everybody under the poverty line is really struggling. But what is probably less well known is that the poverty line doesn't really capture what it truly takes to get by without assistance in a lot of areas. So that's the idea of income adequacy, about how much income does it take to meet your basic needs without relying on public or private assistance, without having to turn to your family or your friends to ask for some money. And asset adequacy is, again, the sense of what does it take to kind of have a cushion to get by if you fall on unexpected hard times. Because I think, as the last few years have highlighted, is that unfortunately, the one thing you can bet on is that you're going to have something unexpected happen right when you probably can least afford it. And that if you have some money in the bank, maybe you can pay for your car to get repaired. You can not have to choose between keeping the lights on or putting food on the table. So those are kind of, they're difficult to define, but the general sense is that some sort of minimum amount to get by without help and to be able to deal with an emergency if it arises.
So we will be talking about poverty a bit, but near poverty, as Rebecca said, it's not just the folks who you see waiting for the bus because they can't afford a car. The mother who lives in your neighborhood who has two or three jobs so that she can afford to put food on the table. Those who, I guess, meet the stereotypical poverty. It's those who can't afford to get the car repaired. It's those who, when they lose the job, is when the real fear strikes. Those are the things we're talking about. And that's a much greater percentage of Virginians. We'll be talking almost specifically about Virginians. There will be a few other questions out there that apply nationally or possibly even globally. But this study was done about Virginians, correct?
Correct. And Virginia historically, and even currently, is traditionally a low poverty state. In terms of national averages, if you look just at the federal poverty line, Virginia as a state has a very low proportion of people below federally defined poverty. And that's actually because of a couple things. Some of them are because of shortcomings in the federal poverty line in truly capturing needs and deprivation. And other things are because of specific demographic characteristics of Virginians.
Tell me about poverty itself. Uh-huh. Because that's, I think for many people, people that they know, people that they see, poverty sort of strikes the image of truly true hardship. Those are the folks who can't afford a place to live or mm-hmm. who share their one or two bedroom apartment with six or eight people mm-hmm. Who are using their food stamps in front of them at the grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that has happened and is mentioned in your report is that there's a problem with using the federal poverty number as even a definition, a defining line.
Yeah, and there are a couple of key drivers of that. And the first is that when the poverty line was developed 40 plus years ago, that food was roughly one third of household budgets. And so since its inception, the poverty line has been benchmarked on the notion that households spend 30% or so of their income on food. And since then, it's been adjusted for inflation. And over that same time, the actual cost of food has declined significantly, although we are seeing tremendous increases in the cost of food right now, which are going to put families in increased difficulty and hardship. But the cost of other necessities, such as natural gas, you know, fuel to put in your car, other things have increased over that time, so that households, I think recently I saw a figure, somewhere between 10 and 15% of their budgets that are spent on food, but the poverty line is based on a 30% food budget. And the bigger issue, though, is that the poverty line is exactly the same no matter where you live. So in Virginia, whether you live in Fairfax or Galax, the poverty line is identical. So in 2009, for a two-adult, two-child household, it was just under $22,000. And what we know is that the cost of living, particularly for housing in Fairfax, is much higher than it is in Galax. It's probably about three times higher. So you can't take – it's not a one-size-fits-all measure, because the cost of living in different places vary tremendously. So that's something that most experts who are studying poverty and a lot of social service organizations, as well as federal programs, are starting to take into account, because they recognize that poverty is not, you have to think about what is the local context as well. Like, what is the cost of living? What are jobs paying in that area? Is there public transportation, or does everybody need to have a car? These all go into helping to address kind of basic needs. And another major thing in the poverty line is that when it was built 40 years ago, the average household had one parent who wasn't working. And now you've seen a tremendous shift. Most households have no stay-at-home parent. So the costs of childcare weren't factored into the initial poverty line, and those are huge costs for most households these days.
Do you even have – I mean, if using the comparison from Fairfax to Galax,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess I have a vision, and I don't know which would be correct, if either, is that there must be a huge number of people suffering poverty in Fairfax – or no people in Fairfax suffering poverty because they can't afford to live there at all.
I mean, I think that what you see is that part of the reason, again, this is what I mentioned with the demographic factors of Virginia that make Virginia as a whole look very good until you start to think about cost of living, is that in Northern Virginia, because of the cost of living, you have relatively high wages, and you also have a very, very educated population. I think about 55% of adults in Northern Virginia have a bachelor's degree or higher. And we do know that higher education is associated with higher incomes, and it's a decreased likelihood of falling into poverty. But when you start to take into account the actual costs of living in Northern Virginia, you see that households in Northern Virginia need nearly three times the federal poverty line to truly kind of get by. This notion of not just, you know, being able to eke out a subsistence living, but being able to put food on the table, pay for their car to get to work, you know, provide minimum health care, live in somewhere that's not luxurious but isn't, you know, infested with roaches. So kind of nothing outlandishly luxurious, but kind of decent housing, adequate food, appropriate child care. And when you shift to the notion that you need to account for kind of meeting all of your basic needs without relying on public or private assistance, and also the fact that you have a tremendous increase in cost of living in Northern Virginia, you see that about 5% of people are in poverty as federally defined. And then when you shift to that alternative definition that's more holistic and accounts for that geography, you see that almost 25% of people actually don't have enough income to meet their basic needs.
11:13 here on the Wake Up Call. We're talking with Rebecca Tippett about near poverty, those of us who have a hard time if and when that unexpected financial event happens. I also want to thank Dixon Disposal for allowing us to be here today. Dixon reminds you that you can reduce household garbage by purchasing products with reuse and recycling in mind. Small changes in your lifestyle can keep our planet green for years to come. When Dixon's picks up your trash, they sort and separate it for recycling. You can help the planet stay green with curbside service from Dixon Disposal at your home or business. Dial them up, 978-2111, online, DixonDisposal.com. Rebecca,
mm-hmm.
One of the questions that I have has to do with the type of job.
Uh-huh.
It's more expensive to live in Fairfax. But Fairfax, and again, this applies to Charlottesville as well, so let's bring this home to Charlottesville. More expensive to live in Charlottesville than in Galax, correct?
Correct. Something I found out the hard way when I moved here a year ago. I was a little surprised.
But it seems that this type of home has more need for the customer service style job that pays less.
Mm-hmm.
Because you did a... one of the formats in your paper listed the number of jobs and the type of job
mm-hmm.
that was more likely to create this style of problem. Retail salespersons, office clerks, cashiers,
mm-hmm.
Food preparation and serving workers, janitors and cleaners. These have the largest estimated number of people working these positions in the state of Virginia. And certainly those of us who have been in Charlottesville long enough know that Charlottesville, Albemarle have a huge need for this style of customer service employee, yet they make the lowest pay. What do we do? This is what I do.
So I think actually, a lot of that has been reflected in recent trends because we do know that Charlottesville and Albemarle are quite expensive, actually, to live in. So you've seen in the past decade, if you look at census data, that there's been some outward shifts in that some of the biggest population growth have been in the surrounding counties like Fluvanna, Nelson, Greene, places where the costs of living are substantially lower. But then you're having people who have to commute significant distances into work because they can't afford to live where they're working. I know that one of my coworkers, you know, she relies very heavily on a home health aide to assist. You know, we know that people's parents are becoming increasing health problems. So she is a home health aide who helps with her mother. And this woman works tremendous hours, yet can't afford to live anywhere close to where she's actually employed. And I don't know. I think you see some initiatives locally that are actually quite heartening from the perspective of somebody who does care about ensuring that people have enough to get by, because I think that that's good for communities, it's good for families, it's good for the communities in which they live. But if you notice, UVA has a commitment to kind of a fairly high wage for all of its workers who are actually employed by UVA. The city of Charlottesville has looked at having a living wage resolution. And I do think that those are definitely steps in the right direction. Is that it's difficult to say how much is enough or what is there to do. And I think, again, this goes back to the fact that it's very much specific to where you're living. And it's not just, you know, one thing that can fix the problem. It's, you know, coming up with solutions that are specific to your community, whether that's improving transportation so that you can reduce household costs, promoting affordable housing. There's definitely some initiatives in the area to increase access to quality affordable homes. I know I saw something recently about a Habitat for Humanity project that's going to be breaking down, I believe, in Albemarle County.
But that's one or two homes.
I thought it was a little bit larger than that.
But okay, and that's me being stereotypical and inaccurate. But we're talking about a much smaller number of specific solutions for the ever-growing number of people in need.
Definitely. And
I don't expect you to have the solution because then I would ask you to run for city council or something.
I mean, it would be great. And I think that a lot of people right now, myself included, are struggling really with how to wrap our heads around the magnitude of the issue, because it's not a single prong issue. It's not just people need more money. It's, you know, where does that money come from? If they're already working 40 to 60 hours a week, is it that we improve job training and we get them in better jobs? Is it that we advocate for all jobs to have a living wage? Is it that you improve social service programs and then you have people who don't, you know, then you're still having people reliant on assistance from others? Is it that you give everybody a college education, which I think would be misguided to some extent because not everybody the high cost of college and a bachelor's isn't necessarily the solution to all of our
and
problems.
And that just pushes the level of education higher
exactly.
for those at the bottom of the pay scale.
Exactly. It's kind of this, I do think that the focus not just on improving, you know, the quality and number of bachelors from, you know, the current push in the General Assembly of improving kind of general educational attainment, I appreciate that it's not just focused on bachelor's, but it's also about technical degrees. You see here local initiatives where Piedmont Community College is pairing with NJIC to create a program that hopefully will benefit local residents as well as local businesses. So yes, these are kind of small scale things. These are not going to address the entire problem, but in many ways, I think that the only way that you can really address it is to have both these small scale, local ground up initiatives at the same time that you have people, talking at the local level, the state level, the national level about, one, how do we understand this? And one of the ways that I think I tried to do in my paper is introduce that before we can even address the issue, we have to have some way of measuring the issue and capturing the issue. You can debate how best to measure it, but ultimately, looking at things from multiple lenses gives us a better perspective on how we can have multiple ongoing solutions, because there is no one solution. There's no magic bullet, unfortunately.
So building a few homes through Habitat for Humanity does help some people, and the more small number of people we help, the larger the total.
Exactly. I mean, for those families, you might say, well, it's only a couple of people, but for those families, that's tremendous. And I also think that those things have hopefully snowballing effects, is that if you can help some people, I don't know, maybe I've seen that Allstate commercial too many times or whatever, where, you know, the guy picks up the children's stroller toy and then so on and so on. But hopefully, I definitely believe that if you can improve economic security for some people, they can become stronger community members. They can give back more. They're going to be more productive employees. Their children are going to have better outcomes. They're going to perform better in school, which then leads to better classroom experiences. There's lots of evidence that suggests that when you strengthen kind of the economic stability of households, it has kind of a ripple effect that it rewards in multiple other arenas.
11:22 here on the Wake Up Call as we talk with Rebecca Tippett about poverty and near poverty, asset adequacy, income adequacy. We'll be jumping into that and what all that means in just a moment. Markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley, partly cloudy and windy today. Highs near low 60s. Mostly cloudy tonight, lows about 44. Mostly sunny and windy tomorrow with small chance of afternoon thundershowers in the valley. Highs in the upper 70s, even warmer in Richmond and Lynchburg. Right now it's a nice day outside, 47 in the valley, 50 in Lynchburg, 52 in Richmond, 51 in Charlottesville.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And let me thank The Backyard for their support. University's culinary secret at the end of Elliewood Avenue. The Backyard has a new spring menu, daily specials, and an ever-changing list of beers on tap. Their outdoor patio is open now for lunch and dinner. The Backyard is available for private events. For more info, it's 202-8215 or thebackyarduva.com. And we were talking earlier about the fundraiser event. Thanks to everyone who pledged my program. Thanks to LaTroile. Thanks to Lee Channing and others who gave specific premiums for that hour. And we also want to congratulate Amy Taylor of Arlington and John Gallant of Charlottesville, the most recent winners from the just-completed Spring Fund Drive. Amy picked up the Duquesne Gas Grill from Martin Hardware. John won the Plan 9 91 second CD run. Pay your pledge by 5 p.m. tomorrow to be entered in the next round of grand prizes. There's the Blue Ridge Mountain Sports Day hiking package and a family summer membership to Fry Spring Beach Club. Thanks to everyone who contributed and helped us hit our goal of $90,000 pledged. All right, we are back in action with our guest today, Rebecca Tippett from UVA's Weldon Cooper Center for Public Service. We were talking about asset adequacy and having enough set aside to handle the unexpected. But I didn't ask you what that amount is and how much time you are expected or hope to be able to have that last.
Definitely. That's a really good question. Again, like anything, this is really open to a lot of different definitions. But the kind of agreed upon one is that, and the one that I use is that asset adequacy. So you have to first define what are assets. In this case, I really think about what can the family or individual easily tap into. So we're talking savings accounts, stocks and bonds, things that are relatively, you know, liquid. So
credit cards?
Credit cards are not an asset. That would be considered a type of debt that you could take on. And those can be helpful to families who have short-term needs and don't have sufficient assets. But ideally, we aren't encouraging people to take on high-cost short-term debt. Although, in the absence of assets, that can definitely help be very critical to, you know, keeping those lights on, putting food on the table, making sure that your car gets repaired so that you get to work and you don't lose your job. Because small negative events can snowball into big catastrophic events. Is if you think about if your car breaks down and you can't get to work and you're working in a non-flexible job with relatively few vacation days, if you can't get to work, you may be out of a job relatively shortly. So having assets to be able to pay for those expenses is really important. And like I was saying, these are readily accessible assets. I do also include retirement accounts there, although those are less than ideal to use because then you're kind of just delaying financial crisis for you know, 10, 20 years down the road, unless you can rebuild those accounts. And not everybody has access to retirement accounts. But in general, you know, I'm not talking about home equity, because where are you going to live if you have to sell your home? And how are you going to sell your home right now in this market? So those are not things on there. And not talking about car values, because people need their cars. We need to be able to get to work, take our kids to childcare, all that stuff. But so assets, kind of money in the bank that you can use, and adequacy. How do we define how much is enough? You know, ideally you have a lot, but if we're going to set a minimum standard, it's typically that you have enough to live for 3 months at the federal poverty line off of your assets. And that 3 month number comes from what the average unemployment spell was prior to the recession. It used to be about 11 or 12 weeks. So unfortunately, what we're seeing right now is that as of, I think, the end of 2010, the average unemployment spell was closer to 22, 24 weeks. So even that measure of asset adequacy of 3 months of cash assets to be able to live at the federal poverty line for that time is kind of not enough to really get by in the current economic situation. It's hopefully enough to provide a buffer for families to meet some emergency needs. But even when you're using that kind of conservative estimate, you still see that almost 30% of Virginia households don't have enough money to get by, which is lower than the national. It's 28% actually in Virginia, which is better than the national average of 30%. But neither of those numbers are particularly heartwarming to see.
1128 on the Wake Up Call. Phone number today, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. That's toll-free. Obviously, this topic goes far beyond just the local number, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS is toll-free. Our guest today, Rebecca Tippett, she has written a paper about near poverty and those who may not meet the fall under the federal poverty line, but would sure have a hard time taking care of all their debts if you lost your job, if you had a financial crisis, if your car needed major repair. Dial us up to put your questions into the radio station. Let me thank Ben Around Tattoos for allowing us to have this. Ben Around Tattoos has thousands of designs available and can create work from a design that you provide them. Ben Around Tattoos in downtown Waynesboro and at 701 West Main Street in Charlottesville. For more information, it's benaroundtattoos.com. Rebecca, early on we talked about how inaccurate the federal poverty line is, and you just talked about the need to have the best percentage of people with asset adequacy, 3 months.
So three, and I think you make a good point there. So I just said 3 months at the federal poverty line, which if anybody was listening to what I said for the last 30 minutes, I just gave a big dialogue about why the federal poverty line is not enough. So if you look, for example, in the Charlottesville MSA, if you said that you needed, let me find, I have this number somewhere here. So 3 months at the federal poverty line in Charlottesville, I estimate about 30% of households in the metropolitan statistical area. So that is Charlottesville City, Albemarle County, Fluvanna, Green, and Nelson, that about 30% of all households in this region don't have sufficient savings to last 3 months at the federal poverty line with no other income. But if you take into account that I just said that the federal poverty line is not sufficient to meet most people's basic needs, and instead you need about double the federal poverty line, that number jumps up to about 37% of people don't have enough to do 3 months of adequate income from their savings. And then if you take into account the fact that the average unemployment spell is no longer 3 months, it's closer to 6 or 7 months, you're looking at about 50% of people who don't have enough in their savings in this area to deal with the cost of living and also the current economy.
So we have a definition of poverty that a majority of people don't agree with being accurate. And we have at least yourself, and I'm sure you represent a much larger number of people who think that even if you change that number, you're really still not accounting for all the other issues that may turn people or force them below any current or future updated number of poverty. Mm-hmm. Do we not change this because of how bad it would look? I mean, you can't get the federal issue changed because now we have a greater number of people in our great country suffering poverty. Well, why isn't this being updated and changed?
In many ways, I think it isn't being updated and changed because it's so entrenched. It's been around for over 40 years, and it's just not going anywhere. But if you do look at a lot of the federal programs and the state programs that are meant to help people who are really struggling economically, you'll see that they actually already account for this to some extent. Very few programs say 100% of the federal poverty line is where we stop giving assistance. I think, I haven't checked it recently, but I know as of a few years ago, the FAMIS program in Virginia, which is insurance for families with children, went up to 200% of the federal poverty line, which is much more consistent with the actual cost of living in most of Virginia, outside of Northern Virginia. You see that a lot of the food stamps, like the supplemental nutrition assistance program or SNAP benefits, which people may be familiar with, those go up to, I believe, 185% of the poverty line. So you see that rather than change the poverty line, what most programs have done is they've said, you know what, we recognize that the poverty line is too low. It fails to adequately capture who really needs help. And so rather than say you don't need help, they say, okay, we're going to expand our definition of who needs help and the universe of people who could receive help by a multiple of the poverty line. And you've also seen that, I think, in the last few years, the Census Bureau, who publishes kind of the official poverty thresholds for the United States, they're starting to release what's called the Supplemental Poverty Measure, which helps take into account some things such as geography as well as medical costs. But it also accounts for taxes and transfers, which, to not be overly jargony, so it accounts for the fact that low and moderate income households often receive tax benefits. They receive things like the earned income tax credit, which is a direct transfer of money at tax time, and that they also do account for transfers or the eligibility to participate in things like food stamp programs, child care assistance, Medicaid or Medicare, things like that. So they're expanding those definitions. Again, we aren't going to see the federal poverty line go away. It's just too entrenched in all of our programs. But we are seeing an increasing discussion around poverty and increasing awareness of the fact that we need to account for more than just the poverty line most of the time.
I asked folks to call in. We do have a caller who asked us to read his question, but you can call in and be on air or ask. Sean McCord is here today to take your question. 979-0919-1877-WNRN Rocks is toll free. Rebecca Tippett from UVA's Weldon Cooper Center, as we talk about poverty and though a greater percentage of people who aren't under the poverty line, but who certainly are very close and near poverty. Rebecca, here's a caller. I see someone's calling in now. But here's Anonymous from Eastern Albemarle. Says that the biggest issues in this area, two parts. Personal health care is too expensive and can break a family. So I'd like you to talk about that. And then I love this one. Banks, insurers, large employers have lower class over a barrel. Service workers and staff at large employers need to come together and form unions. I guess that's I don't know that you want to go on air with that, but let's talk about the personal health care and how that fits into the near poverty scheme.
Health care is probably one of the major drivers of kind of pushing families either to the brink of financial disaster or actually into financial disaster. I know that we've seen tremendous escalation in the cost of healthcare, and the problem is that a lot of individuals who are kind of low or moderate income working class, those people who most need often, you know, affordable healthcare are those least likely to get it from their jobs. So they can't afford the premiums on their own, and they don't have access to them at work. And then the consequences of having a catastrophic health emergency are catastrophic.
It doesn't even have to be catastrophic.
True. I mean, true. Very, very true. Medical bills for even, I know, my sister-in-law broke her wrist recently, and she did not have insurance. The surgery to fix it was almost $30,000, and she was at risk of not being able to meet her mortgage payments because she works in the food industry. She couldn't carry trays to tables, and this was not. You know, that's not catastrophic. She wasn't in the ICU. Nothing was going on, but she was in serious risk of kind of economic disaster. And if you look at bankruptcy filings, you actually see that medical costs are a primary, as in the major cause, of over 50% of bankruptcies. And they're either a primary or a contributing factor in over 95% of bankruptcies. So medical costs are associated with what we consider kind of the most significant indicator of financial distress in the United States, having to declare bankruptcy. And for many other families, I know I've heard from some people who said, we had all these savings. We were doing exactly what you said that you should do. You know, we had more than 3 months of assets saved up. We both had good jobs. We were doing this, and then my husband or I got hurt. We're disabled. We had some medical bills. We couldn't continue working at the same pace. We know all these things. We've done this, but you can only do so much, you know.
Let's take this call. Scott, are you still with us?
I am.
Question, comment for Rebecca?
Yeah, it seems like also hidden in some of the discussions of the poverty level is the notion that for a lot of people, just healthcare is one example, but also retirement. I mean, I am well above the poverty level, but I'm sort of daunted at the amount I need to save for retirement. So even, I wonder, do any of the considerations of poverty level, for example, take into account the fact that ostensibly people should be setting aside money for retirement, for healthcare emergencies? I know you talked about the 3 months of spending, but that doesn't come close to what's needed for those factors. So I wonder what your thoughts on that and the implications of a, you know, aging population and so forth.
That's awesome. Thanks, Scott.
That's a great question, and thank you so much for asking it. And it allows me to go back. That budget that I was talking about doesn't account for savings. So when we think about what it takes to get by and just meet your basic needs, there's no room in that budget for putting aside for emergencies, for saving for the future. And even when you're just talking about meeting your basic needs without relying on public or private assistance, it's 2 times the federal poverty line. So once you start adding in things like needing to save or wanting to save for both for retirement and for emergencies, you're looking at people needing to make significantly more than they're currently making. And I also think that it's important to realize that a lot of people just don't know these things, that there's a huge gap in financial, what we call financial literacy. And I think that financial education, both for people who are kind of entering their working ages and for those of us who are currently working and approaching retirement, is very important. We know that the baby boomer generation, which is currently approaching retirement, has some of the lowest retirement savings we've ever seen. And people are expected to live significantly longer than the current retirement age. You're looking at people living 20, 30 years, and the cost of that can be very high.
11:41 on the Wake Up Call with Rebecca Tippett.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Markins of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
Oh, in 1991, authorities raided three UVA fraternity houses in a massive drug sting operation. 20 years after Operation Equinox, some of those students arrested and at least one of the cops who took them down say we're losing the war on drugs. Is it time for a change? Making positive lifestyle changes is tough. Food tastes good and exercise is hard. Dr. Hook offers tips on how to take baby steps toward a healthier you. And after 3 decades as UVA women's basketball coach, evidence suggests the school pushed her out. Should Debbie Ryan have stayed? The Hook, 52 free issues. And Blue Ridge Mountain Sports supports WNRN. They feature over 130 styles of sandals, hiking and trail running shoes for women, men, and kids. And to go with your footwear, Blue Ridge also has a selection of socks and trekking poles. Blue Ridge Mountain Sports is where outdoor spring adventures have begun for over 30 years. In the Barracks Road Shopping Center in Charlottesville, they're in Richmond, and online, brms.com. And Drew Thompson will be here at noon for Les Temps Purdue, the best 80s and 90s alternative, like Patti Smith, Talk Talk, and NXS, brought to you in part by Orzo and the Visualite. Request always welcome on Les Temps Purdue. All right, phone's ringing, 979-0919. We'll also take a call toll-free, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Rebecca, is it just me being sort of snippy, but isn't poverty and near poverty just going to happen in a free trade capitalistic country? I mean, where the goal for many people is to make as much profit as possible, so therefore your expenses are as low as possible when it comes to paying your employees, etc.?
I definitely can see where that argument comes from. I probably tend to come from the school of thought where I think that, in general, employees benefit when they make sufficient wages to get by, as do employers, because while you can kind of grind out, you know, I think you can really profit from maybe not paying your employees well. I think in general, and maybe this might just be my personal bias, but I think that people work harder when they have strong benefits. They're able to be better focused at work. And maybe, you know, that only applies to certain industries more than others, but I think that that unfortunately might be a tendency, and and this is where not everybody agrees with me, that it's important. I think both, I find it morally important to make sure that people kind of, especially people who are working hard. If you're working hard and you're still struggling to get by, I find that to be really problematic. And I understand that you can't escape it, but it's kind of that notion that for these people who are working 40, 60 hours a week and scrimping and saving and trying to get by, I definitely think that we should be doing things to try to support them and encourage. I like to think that hard work pays off, and I think it's hard for me to see the evidence that often for many families it doesn't.
One of the sentences that I took from your paper, by the way, we are talking with Rebecca Tippett from UVA's Weldon Cooper Center for Public Services, her recent paper, Building Economic Security for Virginia Families. We are talking about poverty. We're talking about a much larger percentage of people in near poverty if the major financial crisis that hits, job loss, divorce, a big car expense, a medical issue, and that puts these families right at the line of falling into federal poverty. The sentence that I picked up was, or the question I turned that sentence into, in what ways do benefits of economic security extend beyond household walls? You talked about how it goes beyond just the family itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that some of the really big arguments for building individual and household economic security are that we know that people who are economically secure are more productive workers, that their children if they have enough money to put food on the table, their children are going to be fed and able to pay attention in school. That means that they're going to probably learn more, be better students, which then sets them up on a path for success. If their children are able to receive preventive medical care, they're going to be healthier, grow up to, you know, lead more productive lives. That if you don't have to work, you know, you don't want your neighbor to worry about being able to make their rent, because you don't want neighbors who are getting evicted or foreclosed upon. Because if you own your home and your neighbor loses their home due to foreclosure, that affects your property values. So having your neighbors economically secure is going to ensure that your home values stay high, that your workplace stays productive, that if you're a small business owner, you want your clientele to be economically secure so that they can pay their bills.
How does that affect me as a taxpayer if we're somehow giving money away to people so that they can meet their asset adequacy, whether the government does it or, you know, doesn't that affect my taxes? And suddenly maybe I want a little money as well so that I can be a little higher up the asset adequacy scale?
I do think that most of the programs we currently have, yes, are tax funded. But in general, I guess what in an ideal system we would have is, and I don't know how we would get here. If I did, I think I would be able to, again, like you said, run for city council or possibly beyond that. But in an ideal system, this is people are able to meet their needs without relying on others. And the hope is that in the intermediate, if you are unable to meet your needs without assistance and you're relying on assistance to, you know, put food on the table or keep your electricity running or help pay for childcare, is that ultimately you will not have to rely on that assistance long term. And I think that the impetus behind most of these programs is that we recognize that households occasionally cannot make ends meet. Right now, many more households are finding that they are unable to make ends meet for a long time period. But the idea is that if you can prevent what we call kind of the long-term consequences, is that if you can help people keep from going hungry during a crisis, and if you can help them pay their bills, then you end up helping them move out of poverty, which then long-term, hopefully they stay out of poverty, which long-term benefits you. So again, it doesn't get rid of your question. That doesn't fully answer your question about, you know, what's in it for me. But I guess the hope is that what's in it for you is a stronger community where ultimately everybody can be a fully contributing member.
So we are talking about poverty, income adequacy, and asset adequacy. One of the issues that's been happening at UVA for years now has been raising the minimum wage for some of the job types that we mentioned earlier, customer service, janitorial, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Raising the minimum wage, while whether you agree or disagree with whether or not that should happen at UVA, doesn't solve the problem, does it? I mean, what level would you have to raise the minimum wage to make this problem go away for a fairly large percentage of individuals and families?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I've had, you know, I've heard on both sides of that issue, and there's kind of the one argument that if you just raise the wage, everybody would be okay. But you're right, it doesn't solve the problem because you can't guarantee everybody a job necessarily. And some of the opponents,
and some of the businesses would raise their prices for the things that people need to purchase.
Exactly. So you could have that happen. I know I've heard from president of the Chamber of Commerce who said, you know, raising the minimum wage is just another way, you know, to kind of ensure that not everybody's going to get a job because it lowers the amount of jobs available. So that's one argument. I don't know that. This is kind of outside of my area of expertise, and it's a little bit more, I think, again, this is something where it might help. There are some, I've seen some recent work that suggests that if you have the minimum wage, if you raise it higher in tandem with keeping things like the earned income tax credit, which is a big bonus kind of or reduction in tax burden at tax time to low-income families that work. So it's saying you work and you don't make enough money probably to get by, but you're working to try to get by, so we're going to reduce your tax burden. There's some evidence that in tandem, those things can help families stay sufficient and reduce reliance on public assistance programs.
All right, let's take a call from James in Lynchburg. Hey, James.
Good morning, guys.
Question or comment?
I'm really enjoying the show. Yeah, there are a lot of businesses around that just don't pay a living wage. And when we go shopping, wouldn't it be better if we all tried to shop places where people are paid a living wage? And I know that there are some businesses, every worker there still qualifies for some type of public assistance. And if we could find a way to shop, spend a little more at the register, we might spend a lot less on taxes and build a stronger community.
I definitely like, you know, this again goes back to the grassroots, ground up efforts versus top down kind of things that you can do. And I think that this is one of those things that might have a good small local impact. I think it's always good to support businesses that are doing things that you agree with. And I definitely know that at least in this area, we're pretty lucky to have, a lot of good local businesses as well. I know I try to buy a lot of my food locally, for example, you know, keep money in the local economy, and also know that if I wanted to, I could go visit them and say, what's up with my food production? So just kind of things like that. I like that idea.
Well, one of the things that, and whether it's accurate or not, certainly my belief is, and thanks, James, for the call, 979-0919. It is 11:53 on the wake-up call. So a few minutes left if you'd like to call and make a ask a question or make your point. It seems that the larger the business, the lower the price. It's one thing to go to, I think the City Market started on Saturday here in downtown Charlottesville, but there are certain grocery stores that are less expensive because it's sort of what I call the Bodo's effect. You sell more, because you're selling more, you can sell them at a lower retail cost.
Mm-hmm.
So there are grocery stores, there are bookstores, and you can almost pick the item that's being sold. And because there are more retailers from this business, you can sell it at a lower price. So if your family need and your family goal is to pay less for the loaf of bread or the gallon of milk for, you know, any other item that you may need, you're going to get it at a less lower retail cost from the larger employer,
mm-hmm.
who can, you know, do whatever, whether you agree with it or not, James says, is to pay the lower hourly wage.
And I think that you definitely just, Rick, you definitely just pinpointed probably where there's a big tension between our personal economic well-being and kind of holistic community economic well-being, is that sometimes if I really want to support things that are maybe of in line with my idealistic vision for the future, it means it might be more out-of-pocket cost for me. And sometimes I'm really good and consistent, and sometimes I find that that my pocketbook dictates my actions more than, you know, my idealistic self would like. So I definitely think that there's a big tension there, and especially a lot of those families, it might be nice to say, yeah, it'd be great to, you know, buy local or buy organic food because I hear that it's better for me or better for the community. But if you can't get enough food because you have to pay those higher prices, then it's just, it becomes a non-issue because the important thing is getting food on the table. And only once you can afford that with some extra savings can you even begin to think about those other, you know, perhaps more idealistic communitarian things.
Yeah, Rick and Rebecca's grocery store, who's paying everyone an above hourly wage and doing the best for what we can offer, is probably has a higher retail price than some of our other more well-known grocery stores in the area.
Mm-hmm.
11:56 here on the wake-up call. This is WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS FM Sweetbriar Amherst Lynchburg. And let me give a shout-out to Sugar Snap for promoting us today, offering gently used baby and kids items, including nursing pillows, maternity and nursing clothes. Also at Sugar Snap, you'll find cloth diapers, diaper bags, and locally made items. They have a kid-friendly play area available while you shop. You can become a fan of Sugar Snap on Facebook or Twitter. You can find them at sugarsnapconsignment.com. Just a few moments left with our guest, Rebecca Tippett from UVA's Weldon Cooper Center for Public Service. We're talking about poverty and a much larger percentage of people who are near poverty, unable for that major financial crisis to keep themselves, I guess, head above water. Is that the proper phrase?
Yeah, making ends meet.
There, I think in your paper you mentioned that there are, state of Virginia is divided into eight regions.
Mm-hmm.
There's Southwest, Northern Virginia, the Richmond area, Central Virginia, Hampton Roads, and among others.
Mm-hmm.
What's the possibility of paying or having different poverty levels based on the region that you live and the cost of living there?
That's actually something I do take into account in the paper. So I did adjust for kind of cost of living in the region when looking at the proportion of people who are not, who are unable to make ends meet, who have inadequate income. And that's actually something that my, office and my coworkers are thinking about looking into. We're thinking about how do you develop something that work, you know, better describes poverty in the state of Virginia, and how do you account for within state variation and differences? Because we do know, again, that Fairfax and Northern Virginia are very expensive. Hampton Roads and Richmond region are also fairly expensive. And then that Southwest, South Side are significantly less expensive in terms of cost of living. So that's something I tried to take into account in this paper, and you do see that it makes a significant difference when you start accounting for cost of living. And it's something that we're going to continue working on as well in our office.
You know, we didn't really talk much about what qualifies as living at the proper means. Are people just living above their means? I mean, what do you, when you talk about buying food, are we talking mm-hmm. about, you know, grocery store butter? Are we talking, you know, and are we talking about expensive? How do you define, you know, what qualifies as is within your means?
That, I think, is something that befuddles most researchers. It's really hard to figure, you know, how do you set a standard? It's inherently subjective, and finding that sort of data is near on impossible. So unfortunately, you know, what we end up doing is that you say, okay, well, what are everybody else in the area using? And you kind of set a budget based on what seems kind of reasonable assumptions about, you know, the cost in an area, and based on those costs in an area, based on kind of what the market says the costs are in the area, what you can then budget for housing, for childcare, for food. And those in general are based on either national surveys of kind of supermarkets and the cost of food based on kind of a thrifty food plan, or what the local market says are the costs for things like housing or childcare. So while obviously if somebody's buying, I don't know, like something very, if they're having filet mignon and crab legs every night, that's going to be an issue, but I'm not budgeting for them to have that either.
Rebecca, thank you so much for coming in. I think, you know, there's got to be a follow-up for this, and we'll love to have you back to talk more about it. I don't think we got into a big chunk of the conversation that we could have continued with. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Drew Thompson up next with Les Thames-Perdue. We'll be back next week for a topic that may make several people uncomfortable. We'll be talking about suicide prevention with suicide survivors and more. Adios.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. And by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasoline, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@AOL.com or at wakeupcall@WNRN.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Sean McCord. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.